the fear of death drives us to do certain things. In fact, the whole concept of terrorism, they argue, they wrote a book after 9/11, is that it's because people are afraid of dying. In other words, the terror is already embedded in every single person. Every person is afraid of dying. What the terrorists do is they break down the constructs, the way we live our life, is we choose either to ignore it or embrace it. And what terrorism does is it breaks down that structure we built around what we call reality. And it's this fear of death that motivates us to act in a certain way. So now we can understand. If it's not gonna work, there you go. This is the slide. So now we can understand why it's so important to take this 6-week course now. Because now death is not just something outside of us. Now death is affecting the way we live our life. So now it's very important to ask and to view how does Judaism view death? Or actually, the best question is, how does Judaism view life? Because if you're going to say death is the cessation, the end of life, so we have to ask ourselves, what's life? Make sense? Okay, in order to understand life, we have to know who you are, right? You have to ask yourselves, who am I? Who am I really? So some people will say, well, I remember my 7th grade teacher was a very scientific, mathematical guy. He came to the class and he said, really? This is back in the 80s. He said, human being is worth about $3. He said, what? Yeah, sand and water, and it's not much, about $3, right? So some people will argue, you know, that it's a mix of cells, and it's not really much. And some people say, human being, life is about getting jobs done, making sure there's gas in the tank, there's milk in the fridge, right? That's what human beings are all about. However, when a person encounters a crisis, a loss of a loved one or death, then we realize that life is very, very fragile. And that's when it's very hard to deny that we're very, very small. And this is the question that Jewish mystics say that we always have to ask ourselves. You know, Jackie Mason, one of my heroes, he's quoted as saying, says, one time I didn't feel like myself. I went to the doctor, and the doctor says, this isn't you. So I said, who is it? It's not me, who is it? He says, I don't know yet. Says, if that's the case, what do I need you? He says, because together, we're going to find out. So he said, but if I don't know even who I am, how will I know who I am if I find it? And he says, and even if I find me, how will I know if it's me? Maybe I should ask my friends, they knew where I last was. And he says, and what if I find me, and I find that he's even worse than the real me? Right? So why even bother? So this is a question we all have to ask ourselves. Who am I really? So we see, look at text 2, Rabbi Chaim Vital. Chaim Vital was the foremost student of the Arizal, the greatest Kabbalist. And he was charged with writing down the Arizal's teachings, and he says, it's known to the wise. Text number 2, page number 3. It's known to the wise that the human body is not the human being. It is merely the body of the human being. When we speak of the human being, we are referring to the inner dimension. The body is merely a garment in which the intellectual soul is attired during its sojourn in the world. So it means your body is not your hand. I mean, you are not your hand. The proof is some people, they cut off their limbs and they're still alive. So you are not your body. You are something outside of your body. So in reality, every day you're having an outer body experience. Sounds very scary. So that means it's not that. Okay, there's 2 seats, front and center, right? For when Avriel comes. Right? So it's not that you have your nose and your stomach, and then you also have your soul. There's something much greater. But it's very important for us to understand what the soul is, for us to appreciate and have a proper perspective on death. They tell the story of a guy who, when he used to go on a date, he always had an escape hatch. His friend would call him like a half hour into the date. And if it was a bad date, he would come back with an excuse, right? So one time he was on a date and the date's going terrible. A half hour and he gets a phone call, he comes back, he goes to the girl and says, I'm sorry, I have to leave. My grandfather just passed. So it's a good thing your grandfather passed, because if not, my grandfather would have to pass. Right? It's very, very important to understand what the neshama is. Because when you understand what the neshama, the soul is, then you can understand who the real you is. There's a story with the Alter Rebbe, Shneur Zalman of Liadi. Once his grandson, Menachem Mendel, was on his lap. And his grandfather asks him, says, Menachem Mendel, says, Avu is the Zayda. Where is grandfather? So he touches his beard. He says, no, that's grandpa's beard. So the child touches his head. He says, no, that's grandpa's head. So he touches the chest. He says, no, that's grandpa's chest. So the kid gets off, goes into the other room, hides behind the door, and screams. So the grandfather thinks something's wrong. He runs into the other room, says, hey, what's wrong? There's the Zayda. So you're a personality. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the town of Chelm. I mean, you heard of the town of Chelm? Chelm is a town in Russia or Poland that's famous for its foolish people. No? Yeah? So one time a Chelmite back then they didn't have private showers, they had bathhouses. So he was worried when he went into the bathhouse, he wouldn't remember who he was because he didn't have his clothes on. Right? You're identified by your clothes. So he decided he was going to tie a red string around his big toe. That's how he knew who he was. But he was in the shower, the string fell off, and somehow wrapped around another person's toe. So he goes over to the guy and says, I know who you are, but I don't know who I am. Right? So let's discuss what the neshama is. It really is. It's not the intellect, and it's not your emotions, it's not your desires. The thing about the word soul is, there's certain words we always use and we pretend we know. Or we're in a conversation, right? So we're talking about the Big Bang Theory, all like, yeah, yeah, relativity, Big Bang, yeah, 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 electricity, yeah. Meantime, all I know is electricity is, I flip on the switch, light turns on, that's what I know about electricity. How? I don't know. Want to know proof? Ask my wife. I almost blew up a building when we lived in Argentina. I shut down the electricity for half a building. Like, I know about electricity, right? The soul is also one of those words. The one of those words that we pretend to know, but it's very important that we analyze it. So the question for discussion, this is on page number 4. This is a question you should be asking yourself. What analogy would you use to describe the body and soul relationship? The problem with the soul is that it's not physical. And when something's not physical, it's very hard for us to understand. Let me get Kabbalistic for a second, if I may. In Kabbalah, or Kabbalah, for the Sephardim here, okay, gotta cater to the crowd. There's what's called, I'll say it in English, there's the fact that you know that it exists, and then there's the knowledge how it exists. Let me expand. Let's take God for example, right? He's a great example. There's Yediyat HaMahut, how he exists, and Yediyat HaMatzius, that he exists. Meaning, we all know that God exists. There's a world, he created it. But if I asked you how God exists, what is his existence? Oh, I don't know. The soul is the same thing. Meaning, we know what the soul is not, but no one can define what the soul is. We know it's called, in Hebrew, Yediyat HaShlila, knowing what the soul is not. So let's discuss what the soul is. Meaning, let's look at the Torah for a source of what the soul is. Text number 3a, page number 4. The first time the soul appears in the Torah is in Genesis, right in the beginning. It says that God formed man, the dust from the earth, and breathed in him his nostrils, his neshama, and man became a living thing. That was on the sixth day of creation. Now look at the next text. To look at what happened in the fifth day of creation. And God said, let the earth bring forth living beings of different species, cattle, and it was so. Anybody can spot the difference? You know, like in the Sunday paper, can you spot the difference here? No, don't be bashful. I'm going to call on you.
No mention of soul, there's no mention of soul.
Okay, yeah, yeah. Something more specific, right?
Well,
But why is there no mention of soul? Let me direct you.
Sam? Breathing life into.
So let's give him a try.
A lack of awareness.
So to put it into words, if you realize by the man, by the human being, man formed the body and then breathed into a soul. With an animals, we don't have that distinction. We don't have that two-part creation. When God said, let there be animals, the animals came up from the ground. The soul and body is one entity. So what does that tell you? It tells us something very, very powerful. That the soul is not an entity connected to the body. The soul is a totally separate entity. That for a time being, whatever the time is, 70, 80, 120 years, it happens to hang out with the body. But the soul is actually separate from the body. So, and as opposed to an animal, the soul is one with the body. So therefore, it's not the same as the death of an animal is not the same as a human being. As you see in text, see Rabbi Chizkiah ben Manoach the Chizkuni writes. I can say it in English. God did what he had not done with any other creature. He blew into Adam and his. Oh, I'm behind him, my slides are. He blew into Adam with any other creature, his holy breath and the Shema that is immortal and does not perish when the body does. So that means, not only is your eye not the body, but the true self does not even inhibit the body. That means your true self is not even inside your body. There's a relationship with the body which we call life. But your true neshama, your true self, is not inside the body. Why I'm saying it's important? Because later on when we discuss heaven and hell, in Judaism, I don't want to get into it because it's for later, so just to give you a little teaser. Because in Judaism, we believe everybody goes to heaven. I know there's a saying, all dogs go to heaven, but all people go to heaven too. Right? But you have to ask yourself, well, let's say a guy is a really wretched, rotten person. Does he also go to heaven? So the Torah says every Jew goes to heaven. It's one of the fundamentals of Jewish belief. It's brought down in the Gemara. Every single Jew has a share in the world to come. How can this be? Because your you is not created together with your body, and therefore does not perish when the body does. So now you have over here. So to summarize a little bit. The real you is your soul, not your body. And the real you, because it's your soul, it's not your body, it's eternal. You have a question?
But where is my soul hanging out?
Okay.
Maybe my heart is hanging out.
Right. Okay. Your soul,
it's not.
No, meaning there's a relationship that's currently happening between your body and your soul.
Correct.
So, meaning because, I don't know if we'll touch about it later. That your soul is what's called a part of God, and therefore it is a part of you that is so holy it can't descend, so to speak, into the body completely. So it has a relationship which vitalizes and animates your body. But is a part of you that's not even vested in you. Therefore, that's why the concept of, we're going to get to it later in the lesson, there's no really death and afterlife. There's only life with the soul. It's only a question of relationship to the physical world. Make sense? Okay. So, summarize. So the mystics, so they explain the eye is the neshama, and animals don't have that same eye because they were created all one with the earth, as opposed to we. So we were created separately, and now, so we'll do a little study partner exercise. You see on page 6, there's two very fascinating texts. The text 4 and text 5. Text 5 is on page 7. I'll read it and you guys can, in the words of, who was that lady who said, discuss amongst yourselves, right?
Joan Rivers.
I wasn't sure it was Joan Rivers. Listen, I grew up in Brooklyn, you know, there's certain things you gotta know. I have a Jewish mother too. So 40 days before the conception of a child, God summons the angel in charge of souls and tells him, bring me the certain soul. I'm just going to read through it quickly. The angel goes and brings a soul, and the soul says, no, I don't want to go down to earth. And so I'm very happy where I am. And why do you want me to go down into this putrid drop? And then there's a Mishnah in the Ethics of Our Father that says, this world is like an antechamber before the world to come. Prepare yourself in the antechamber so you may enter the palace. A single moment of bliss in this world is greater than all the world, than all this world. All right. So what do you think these texts teach us? What lesson do you think comes from this, comes from these texts? How do you think that the soul views this world?
Continuous.
I'm saying, how does it want to come down?
Right.
It's a lesser place. It doesn't want, right? Meaning, not only is the soul not physical, the soul has no interest in coming over here. It doesn't desire. And therefore, God has to, we'll see later, God has to say, no, I need you to go down. The soul is like a stranger in a strange land. It's a stranger on foreign soil. And therefore, When a person passes on, when a person experiences death, it's not something bad happens to the soul. The soul just goes back to its previous idyllic, tranquil state that it was before. So meaning, the life that a person has here is just an incident that happens in the course of the span of existence of the soul. So up until this point. A soul in the body is like a stranger on foreign soil. So to recap, because we're going to stop here to recap, because now we're going to explain the other side of the coin. The real me is not the soul. I say it's not the body, it's the soul. The real me, the soul, is eternal, hence I am eternal. And the real me is unaffected by birth, and because it's unaffected by birth, it's also unaffected by death. So this is the point. Why are we even born? What are we doing here? Why would God make the soul come down here? And if that's the point, and let me just go off the edge a little bit. You guys don't have anything to worry about. But why aren't we the ones blowing up buildings? Right? If life is nothing, then you see the correlation? So it's very important at this point to discuss Judaism's view on life, not the soul, the life down here. Because there's, you see in Appendix A, on page 18. Appendix A, page 18. There's a from the Radvaz, Rab David Ibn. I forget his last name. His last name isn't Andrusier, so. Zimra. Thank you. Like I told you, it's not Andrusier. So he writes something very interesting. There's a prohibition in the Torah that says you're not allowed to mutilate yourself. Back then in the old time, the Gentiles would mutilate themselves on the death of a loved one. So he says you're not allowed to mutilate yourself. Why? Because a person who mutilates himself is saying that I'm so devastated by the death of my loved one that I can't go on. But he says that's not our view. Our view is that the soul does live on. The soul does exist. And therefore, there's no reason to hurt yourself. But he says, in fact, he lived in Morocco, so he was he knew firsthand how the Muslims acted, and he said the Muslims they abhor any mourning, but he says Judaism takes the middle ground. So we mourn. It's death is bad, the tragedy, but at the same time, not too much. But you can kind of see, what's going on lately, why they do what they do. And us people who live in the West, and us Jewish people, we struggle to understand. Don't they want to go to Baskin Robbins and watch the jet? There's so much to live for, but to them, this life is nothing. So therefore, they have no problem dying. And that's where this radical. That's some of it where the radical approach stems from. But the Judaism, the assumption that they don't care about death it's not true. And how do we know it's not true? Because your job as the students is to challenge me. Can't just say, oh, he's the rabbi, he must know what he's talking about, right? although of course it's true. We have to bring a proof from the Torah. In the Torah, there's a law, and we have some doctors here. That bikuach nefesh deiches akel means life-threatening circumstances push off every single mitzvah. You see, there's a text from there's an appendix from the Rambam on page 19. That what happens if somebody is on his deathbed on Shabbat means you know he's going to die in the next hour, five. It doesn't make a difference. And you can extend his life by a few minutes, 5 minutes, by violating the Shabbos. Let's say lighting a fire. You have to violate the Shabbos just to get the extra 5 minutes. Hello. Yes, there's one seat here and one seat there. Right. There's one there, one there. Is it? There's two here. There's two here. Is Avery come? No. Okay, so still one here. Okay, baby Joe and. All right. Thank you. The rabbi's wife doesn't come on time. What do you expect from me when I make money? Gotta set an example. So he says over there, you have to violate Shabbos to lengthen someone's life. And going back to where we are on text number eight. The Rashi, Shlomo Yitzchaki, the famous. I think you have the. Do you have the biographies there? No.
Yes.
Yeah. Shlomo Yitzchaki is the foremost commentator on the entire Torah. We're on page eight. More precious before God than the mitzvot are the lives of Israel. Now notice, so some people think the reason why we violate Shabbat, for example, Yom Kippur, is in order that the person should be able to fulfill more mitzvot in the future. That's not what Rashi is saying here. He's not saying that we want to violate in order to keep more mitzvot, because then we don't really care about the person's life, we care about the mitzvah. That's not what he's saying here. Read carefully. More precious before God than the mitzvot are the lives of Israel. So we don't care if this guy is the biggest sinner in the world. We don't care if this guy never put on tefillah, never kept Shabbat, right? Never doesn't even know how to do a mitzvah. We do everything we can to try to bring this person back. And now, even if there's a doubt, the Gemara talks about, let's say, there's a collapsed building. And you don't even know if the guy's alive or dead. You don't know. You go and violate Shabbat. So here we learn out that the soul occupation of, is more important. The soul is more important than the mitzvot itself. So just the fact that you are a living, breathing Jewish person, you're a holy person. Nothing to do with what you do. That's why you often hear me say there's no such thing as a bad Jew. You can't be. Every Jew is a holy Jew. There's no such thing as a bad Jew. You have a godly spark in you. Then you're automatically holy. So now the question is, though. Oops, sorry. And you see the question on page number eight. Say, is where you got to take out your thumbs. You know, Talmud. On one hand, we say that there's the soul, and the only thing that matters is the soul, and the soul doesn't get affected by life down here on earth, and the soul is everything. You're not even you. You're somebody else, like Jackie Mason said. On the other hand, we're saying life is everything. We have to try to keep the soul down here on earth as long as possible. So which one is it? Right, he's right and he's right. They both can't be right. So what do they say in Fiddle on the Roof? You're also right. Hey.
To fulfill the mission of the mitzvah.
So which one is it? Is it down here or is it up there?
That's what I'm saying. Here.
Oh, so you're saying here, but then we have a thing. We have to reconcile it too, because we have proofs and texts to support both. Yeah, go ahead.
I don't know if I'm misunderstanding you, but if you're saying we do everything we can to keep the body alive,
yeah,
how do you reconcile the DNR?
That's a very good question, and I gave that. No, the one here from the hospital. But there's a JLI course called Medicine and Morals. And it's a lengthy discussion. It's a very good question. But we're going to focus on the relationship of the body and soul. And it's not a simple question. Like I'm saying, no, it's a very good question, but for the sake of the class, because you want to end at 9 o'clock, 9:30, I'm saying instead of 11 o'clock, you know, listen, I have a babysitter. I'll be here, you know. Yeah, I'm excited. So I have no problem. Okay. The answer, my friends, is it's nuanced and sophisticated. It's not one or the other, it's both. I mean like this. It's true that the soul is eternal, given. And the soul doesn't want to really come, down here. However, the whole reason why God created the soul, formed the soul, is to come down here. That's the only reason why God made it. In fact, that's the reason why God created the world. You guys are very important. If not for you, God wouldn't create the world. Look at text number 7 on page number 9. When God created the world, he said, if the Jewish people accept the Torah, then... behind him, I text it. Then you will continue to exist, he tells the world. It says, if not, then I will return everything to nothingness. Go ahead, Doug.
Did God and people exist before the Torah?
God exists.
In the physical sense of the word.
No. God existence we're not going to talk about because he's beyond our realm of understanding. But God created the Torah before he created the world. So
not
it said,
in the physical universe.
Well, what do you call physical Torah? You mean the Torah scroll? The Torah scroll is just ideas dictated on parchment. The Torah is much bigger because we have the written Torah and we have the oral law. And the written law is really cryptic and we don't really understand it. So the idea that the Torah, there's a medrash, without getting too off the subject, there's a medrash that says that Adam learned Torah, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, they all learned Torah. In fact, one of the questions the Rebbe speaks about at length is what was the purpose of the giving of the Torah? If we already had Torah before. Saying, we had the Torah already in advance. The focus, we actually read it last week, the stress of the word is the giving of the Torah. I mean that God bequeathed it to us instead of us just accessing it on our own. Understand? So when you see a Torah scroll, that's just words that God dictated to Moshe to reference ideas that we need to know throughout life. But the Torah existed even before. So Abraham, we have a book. It's actually printed. There's an argument whether Adam wrote it or Abraham wrote it. It's called the Book of Yetzirah. You can look for it. It's online. Have it. Saying, and where do they know that from? So, Judaism is not a religion that we believe our forefathers were idiots. Just the opposite. We believe we're idiots and they're the ones over there, right? You know, Mark Twain, last thing before we go on. I think it was Mark Twain. If it wasn't him, he said a bunch of other smart things, so we'll, right? He said, when I was in my 20s, I thought I knew everything, my parents knew nothing. When I was in my 30s, I realized, maybe my parents know a few things. When I was in my 40s, I realized the whole time I knew nothing and my parents knew everything, right? Okay, so getting back to the soul. The whole reason why we're created is for us to come down here. There's a story of a very holy man. His name is the Chayza of Lublin. At one time, after Yom Kippur, he told everybody, if you come to me, I will tell you what you prayed for, and I will tell you what God answered. So one guy works up the guts, and he goes up to the Chayza, and the Chayza puts his holy hand on the student's head, and he says, you prayed that you should only be able to work one day a week, and you should be able to study and pray for 6 days a week. And he smiles and says, you know what God's answer is? If I wanted that, I wouldn't have created you in the first place. That's his answer. Meaning, God wants us to come down here and work, meaning despite all the temptations that we have to not do what we have to do, to still overcome the desires and the temptations of the world to come and fulfill our mission. And what did he do to reward us? He created the Garden of Eden, or the world to come. Because otherwise, why would we do what we want to do, right? God had to put some incentive program in order for us to... Hey, he asks us to put these funny boxes on our head every day. You know, you got to say, you know, I think in psychology they have a what's in it for me, right? Every person has it. What's in it for me? I'm not putting these crazy boxes on my head. Let me tell you something. I'm not going to tell the whole story, but I was on a bus. I landed in the airport, not Charles de Gaulle, the smaller airport in Paris.
Orly.
Thank you, Orly. And I was, it was touring with my friend, and I didn't want to waste time, so I decided to pray on the bus. And this was 2003, I think. So I'm sitting there, and I don't know, I guess in England they didn't get the memo, you're not supposed to steer. The whole bus was gawking at me. And I went to, you know, part of the prayer, you got to get your tzitzit. When I went to get my tzitzit, this woman jumped up, right? And she thought I was going to blow up the bus. It was a whole to-do, right? You know, so there better be something in it for me that I'm putting on these black boxes and going to Aroma and spending $14 for a steak, right? Right? There's got to be some reward, right? But the purpose isn't the reward. The purpose is, like, I don't know how many of you guys are employers or employees, right? But when you get the employer, they don't want to give the paycheck. You want to keep the money for yourself. But obviously, the people aren't going to come to work for no money, right? So the reward for doing the mitzvot, that's secondary. It's the soul coming down to do the mitzvot. That's the purpose. Think of it as a guy proposes for a woman, right? Proposes for a woman and she says yes. Shock. And he hires, he gets the best hall and the caterer and the florist and the photographer and everything, he gets everything for the wedding. And a few days before the wedding, she gets cold feet. She pulls out. Now, how does he look at the caterer in the hall? It's a nuisance. Right? There are details that he has to deal with now. I don't know if you guys heard in the news a few months ago, this happened to somebody. And instead of canceling the wedding, they invited all the homeless. Did you hear about this?
Yes.
They invited all the homeless to eat at the meal because it was already paid for. But this is how we look at the world. Everything we do is everything that God created. Think of it, I don't know how much you know about the spiritual worlds and Atzilus, all the spiritual stuff you can think of. Everything down to, you know, this week is the Super Bowl, right? It wouldn't be a good class if I didn't mention sports, right? So you have the commercials and everything, but what's it all for? It's for the football game on the field. You don't have that game, then everything goes away. So everything you see around the world is only for you to do a mitzvah. That's powerful stuff. And that's why there's nothing more important in Judaism than life. Because life means the ability to do a mitzvah. And this explains a story. This explains a story. You see in text number 8 on page 9. When Rabbi Huda Nasi was dying, so his student Rabbi Chiya went into him and he saw he was crying. And he said to him, Rabbi, teacher, master, we have a tradition that says if a person is crying when he's dying, it's a bad omen. If he's smiling, it's a good omen. Why? Well, simply because if he's crying, it means he's afraid, and he hasn't acted the way he's supposed to. If he's smiling, that means he's confident. He says, why are you crying? He says, Rabbi was a man who didn't sin. Never. Why are you crying? He says, I'm not crying. He says, I weep. He says, because I'm afraid of dying. I weep because of the Torah and the commandments that I will no longer be able to study and observe. So Rebbe didn't fear death, but he wasn't looking forward to it either. This is the two sides of the coin that Judaism has. We don't want to die, but we're not afraid to die. So the Jewish perspective on life and death is nuanced. On one hand, the soul is eternal, and it's at home in the spiritual realms. It wants to be there. On the other hand, the neshama understands, the soul understands that it has to come down here. And this explains a very, very enigmatic Mishnah. You see a text number 9, page 10. Very, very weird Mishnah that says, against your will you're formed, against your will you're born, against your will you live, and against your will you die. Well, let me ask you a question. If against your will you live, then when it comes time to die, don't you just die? What does it mean against your will you die? And if against your will you die, then you should just live. How can you have against your will you live and against your will you die? I mean, can't the rabbis just say it? You know, just say it. Why do they go, got to be back and forth?
I want to make us think.
You got to want to make us think, exactly. Right?
What did he say?
He wanted to make us think. So it reminds me of a joke, which I'll tell later on.
Please,
right?
Expand.
Right? So, So based on what we explained before, this is going to make sense. We're forced to live because the soul doesn't want to descend, because it's happy in the spiritual realms. It's happy in paradise. But when it comes down here and it does a mitzvah and it realizes the preciousness of a mitzvah, it doesn't want to go back. I just went to Orlando with my family. We had winter vacation. So we went on a roller coaster. I went on with two kids. So Sarah's like a daring one and Chaya. So it's in there. And starts going up and Chaya starts crying. She doesn't want to go. I don't want to get off. But you know, once the clicks, it's too late. And she was behind me. She was with Sarah because she wants to sit with Sarah. And I was the whole time on the roller coaster. I'm saying, "Hi, don't worry, it's okay, it's almost over. After the ride's over, I look back at her, she's laughing. She had the great time. Like, "Wait, what happened? I thought you were bowling and going crazy." Well, this is exactly what the soul. Before, on the way down, I don't want to go. But when it's going through the ride, it realizes this is really fun. And what we can do here, we can't do anywhere else. And I don't want to get off. And this is the continuation. To what we had on page six. This is the end of that quote. You see on page 10. As soon as the soul says no, I don't want to go down. God responds to the soul and says the world to which I'm sending you is better. Is better. Than the one in which you dwelt until now. When I created you, I did this from this drop. At the moment, God inserts it against its will. That means, God tells the soul, I know you think that up here is great, and this is the life, but I'm telling you, what you can do down there is much better. So here's the nuance. There's a difference between importance and hana, and benefit. The soul up there, let's go back a second. The soul up there, it has more pleasure, right? It's close to God. Difference between pleasure and importance. So it doesn't want to leave because there it's more pleasurable. But when it comes down here, this is where it feels it's needed. This is where it's important. And that's why the soul it comes down. So while in heaven, the soul is reluctant to leave. Against your will, you live. On earth, the soul doesn't want to leave. Against the will, you die. Before we go on, any questions? We pause for questions? Yes, Garcia, go ahead.
Maybe silly what I'm going to ask.
No such thing.
Are all the souls the same quality? Because there's rotten people in this world, and they have souls.
Okay, that's a very good question. I'll try to answer it on a very, very brief. Question is addressed in a book very close to called Tanya, in chapters 2, and it's in the bookshelf, in chapters 2 and 3 of Tanya, where the Alter Rebbe explains in chapter 2 that every single soul is a part of God, and therefore it enjoys the same holiness. The question is, in order for the soul to go from point A to point B, meaning from paradise to the soul, it has to go through a process. Think of it maybe like oil. We take oil out of the ground. You can't put it into your car. It has to be refined. It has to go through some process. Through that process, the oil you have 97, 93, 87, whatever it is. Right? Similarly, the soul. When a soul descends into this world, it takes upon itself different garments or obscurities that does not allow it to feel its holy source when it's connected to the body. Thus, when a person is overcome by urge to do something wrong, his godly soul doesn't have enough kick to fight back, which really life is. Your urge to do godly and the urge to do something selfish. Yeah, good. Yeah, good.
Following that question then, going back after you die, would you go, everybody goes to the same level of heaven?
No. No, because as I said before, that paradise is corresponding to what you do. It's a reward for your actions. So there's the soul before, and then there's the soul after. Later on, I'm not sure which lesson, because I kind of went through them all, and they're all one big challenge. But later on, I'm going to speak about the purpose of reincarnation, and why the soul comes back. Because reincarnation is based on what the soul does down here. And based on what the soul does down here, that will set the terms for if it has to come back and how long it has to come back and what it has to do and all those different type of things.
And all of us have new souls.
No.
We get a new soul.
No. You don't get a new soul. Okay, last thing. I know this is very interesting, the reason why you don't get a new soul is because all our soul Kabbalistically stem from the 600,000 soul that stood around Mount Sinai. It has to be that way. Otherwise, we have no connection to Sinai. If you're a brand new creation, then why should you have any bond or obligation to fill the Torah? Make sense? We stem from them. But we'll talk about incarnation and all that. That's going to be addressed. That's going to be addressed later on at length. So, to this explain what we just said. You see, text 11 on page 11. So now we can get back to the I pronounced a big word before, Pam, you weren't here. The thanatophobia. I shouldn't have said it. I knew I was. See, when you weren't here, no one corrected me. it's like when my wife was saying, right? They say if a man is says something in the forest and his wife's not there to hear him, is he still wrong, right? Right. So far we've learned that we value life more than anything, and therefore. But because the soul is eternal, death is not the end. And this is going to explain one of my favorite stories. One of my heroes was the previous Rebbe of Lubavitch. And I don't know if I have the book here. Previous Rebbe of Lubavitch became Rebbe in 1920, at the beginning of communism. And he was a troublemaker. He was a very, very big pain for the Bolsheviks. You know, he was a troublemaker. He was a revolutionary for the counter-revolutionaries, and he was arrested multiple times. He was such a pain. They finally just kicked him out of Russia. You can't leave. Anyway, so one of the times they interrogated him, and as the custom of the Friedrich Rebbe, saying Yiddish, the previous Rebbe, he didn't cooperate. He didn't give them importance. He didn't cooperate. So a guy got the interrogator got very nervous. He picked up his revolver. Said, "You see this toy? This toy has a way of making people talk." It says people who are very, very tough, they melt. And even those who have principles all of a sudden opens up. And even those who are mute all of a sudden begin to talk. Friedrich Rebbe looks him in the eye and says, "Your toy only makes people afraid who have one world and many gods. But I have one god and two worlds. So I'm not intimidated by your toy. And it has no effect on me whatsoever." Now, what's the Friedrich Rebbe trying to do over here? Trying to be a tough guy? Wait, the Friedrich Rebbe didn't want to, he's on a death mission? No, the Friedrich Rebbe wanted to live. But at the same time, because he understood that what the soul is and the soul's eternal, he wasn't afraid of death. Meaning, The way Judaism deals with thanatophobia, did I say it right? Mm-hmm. Thank you. It allows us to truly live. Because when we truly live, we don't have the fear, we don't have the fear of death. And with this, we move on to another point. King Solomon, he's a pretty smart guy. He said a few things that, you know. And he said he's even smarter than Mark Twain. And he said something very interesting. He said, everything has an appointed season. You see in text 12a. Everything has an appointed season. There's a time for every matter under the heaven, a time to be born and a time to live. That means there's no such thing, according to Judaism, there's no such thing as premature death. Every single person. So I know for some people, it's a very difficult and to swallow. And some people have suffered. Meaning, as you say in text 12b, the Medrash explains: there's a time to be born and a time to die. So the Marsha says something. He says that a person is destined down to the month and the day of how long a person is going to live. And therefore, we must believe, continuing text 13, that no created being can benefit or harm us without the permission of the Creator. It doesn't mean we go out looking for trouble. That's not our style. But we believe that God allotted us time, and we have to make the most of the time. And we say it on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. If you see on page 20, then Unesana Tokef. The Sana Tokef is the most famous prayer on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. We say, you know, we're there. Who shall live and who shall die? And we go through the whole prayer. It's a very moving prayer. So on face value, oh my God, it's very morbid. We're talking about death. But if you think about it, it's actually, it says, it's very comforting. Because we know that I have nothing to be afraid of. Because whatever God decides, so he's going to decide. So obviously we have to do as much as possible to preserve life. You know, we're not going and, you know, I want to go skydiving and my wife doesn't let me, right? Because it's all a question of how you look at it, to preserve life or I have my allotted time, right? So we can't go looking for trouble, but it's not that we have to worry that this beginning of the next phase of when the soul departs from the body is going to come at a time when we're not sure. And this can explain why Reb Chiya, when he saw his teacher crying, couldn't understand. You Rebbe, should know. You shouldn't be afraid. But now we can understand why he had that that reaction. This leads us to the final part of tonight's discussion. There's a very interesting line in the Gemara in Brachot that says, you see text number 14, that tzaddik and righteous people are considered alive even after their demise. Text number 14, yes. Page 13, text 14. It gets a little confused. So what does it mean to be alive after you're dead? We're not talking Elvis here. That's sure. So the neshama is alive. Okay. Anyone else?
The memory
legacy. That's true. But if this were the case, if what you're saying was if only what you're saying was true, because what you're saying is true. If only what you're saying is true, then why would the Talmud only say righteous people? If everybody has a soul, the Gemara should say, anyone who has a soul is alive after the dead. Doug?
Righteous people do more good, more mitzvahs.
So now it's a question of percentage.
But didn't you say every Jew is born with a good soul?
Every Jew is born with a godly soul, yeah. So every godly soul should be alive. So what does Gemara mean over here?
Yeah, that's so, if every Jew is born with a godly soul, what about people that convert?
Okay. Mm. That's a good question. It's not an expected craft. If you come after, I'll talk about it. It's a very good question. But that's there's another course which we can do. It's called the Kabbalah of the Soul. Mm-hmm. So, but I can answer that question after. But it's a very, very good question. They're all very good questions, but for the purpose of, you know, time constraints, we can't answer all the questions. Yeah, go ahead.
The impact they have upon other people, particularly people studying under them.
Okay, so it's legacy, I said before. All right. So let's go back to the Tanya for a second, which I referenced earlier. Abshir Zalman explains that each of us suffer. Sorry, Pam. Actually, this is great for Pam, because this is put her in business. Each of us suffer from multiple personality disorder. I don't know. I mean, each of us have two identities and two consciousness. It's a fact. We have a godly consciousness and a godly personality, and it's called an animal personality, not because we act like animals, because just like animals are selfish, meaning it's called human, right?
Yitzhar.
Not Yitzhar. It's not the Yitzhar. Yitzhar is something else. This is a existential. It's what keeps you alive. You eat. Okay. The question becomes in life, which personality do you allow to shine? So every personality, the godly and the bodily personality, each have its dreams, its aspirations, its passions. The question is, which one are you actualizing? So if your whole life is made up of pursuing your bodily pursuits of car, house, you know, whatever it is, clothing. So then what happens when a person passes on? Yeah, death is very, very, very scary. Because then it all comes to an end. Wasn't there a story many years ago of a woman got buried in her Ferrari?
Yeah.
Right? So, you know, they tell the story of a guy who wanted a tax write-off, but he was too cheap to the to actually give the money. So he had $120,000. He gave $40 to the priest, $40 to the minister, and $40 to the rabbi. And he said, "But you have to, in my grave, you have to put the money in it." So at the grave, so after the funerals, asked the priest, "What do you do?" He says, "Well, what am I supposed to do? Last dying man's wishes. I put the $40,000 into the grave, right?" So they asked the priest, the minister, what do you do?" So I gave him, but I took off 10%, you know, for the temple, you know, for the center, whatever they call their house of worship. So asked the rabbi, "What do you do?" Says, "I cut him a check for $40,000." Right? So the question is: if a person's life is defined by, am I behind in my? Yeah, I think I am. All right. So if a person's life is defined by acquiring stuff for the body, so then once the body ceases to be, so then it's very scary. But if a person allows his godly personality to shine, and its passions and desires are greater than itself, meaning greater than his body, it's something spiritual, not only spiritual, it's tangible, but it's something that's not necessarily tied down to physical, so then these actions don't cease to be when the person passes away. I'm going to show you a video that's going to explain better what I'm saying. And let there be light.
Is a popular Hasidic rock band. One of their hits was inspired by a powerful episode in the life of the second leader of the Hasidic movement, Rabbi Dovber of Meserich.
A student goes to visit a sage, and the sage has nothing in his house. He says, "Where's your couches? Where's your chandelier?" And he says back to the student, "Where's all your stuff? You just have a suitcase." And the student responds, "But I'm just passing through." And that's when the sage says, "Aha, just like you, I'm also just passing through."
To his student's assertion, Rabbi Dovber responded with a transformative insight.
That's when he said, "I'm just like you, I'm just passing through, just like you, my heart.